For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJO podcast.
When we know the number of people out there who are at high risk based on their genotype, it doesn't match the number of people who we're finding with the current rates of testing. In fact, we're just scratching the surface. So that really provides a rationale for a population-based testing strategy, which is what we're proposing.
That was Associate Professor Paul Lacaz, who is Head of Public Health Genomics at Monash University. Paul and his colleagues have designed a pilot study to test DNA screening for three adult genomic conditions: hereditary breast and ovarian cancer, Lynch syndrome, and familial hypercholesterolemia. It's their theory that population screening will find people at high risk who are currently not meeting the narrow criteria for genetic testing. Those who are found can then be directed towards early intervention and management to reduce their risk going forward. Recruitment for the pilot study begins in July. Paul is my special guest today. So you and your colleagues have written a perspective about DNA screening. What is it, and what's the difference between DNA screening and genetic screening?
So there's different types of genetic screening that we can talk about. What we're focused on is adult genetic screening or population-based genetic testing in adults for their own personal risk. And I guess genetic screening and DNA screening can be used interchangeably. We like to use DNA screening because DNA resonates with the public quite well. It's a bit more so than genetic screening or genetics in general. There would be newborn genetic screening is one type of potential genetic screening. Reproductive carrier screening, where a couple will both have screening for recessive carrier status for recessive conditions for the risk of their child for early onset childhood genetic diseases. And then there's also pre-implantation genetic testing or screening. There's maternal DNA testing in maternal blood. So there's all these different types of screening, but really the one that we're focused on is adult DNA screening for personal risk of cancer and heart disease. What we're focusing on are three adult onset genomic conditions where monogenic variants, so these are a pathogenic DNA variants that occur in a single gene, confer a very high risk of future disease, and that very importantly that disease has risk management interventions and early detection possible, where you can action the genetic result. So those that we're focusing on are hereditary breast and ovarian cancer. So that's the BRCA1 and 2 genes that confer high risk of breast and ovarian cancer in women. Lynch syndrome, which is hereditary risk of bowel cancer and other types of gastrointestinal and other cancers. And familial hypercholesterolemia, which is genetic high cholesterol, which can be managed with statins or other lipid-lowering treatments. So those three conditions are quite common in the population. If you add them up, they affect about 1 in 75 individuals, or at least 1 in 75 individuals are at genetic risk of one of those three conditions. And there's guidelines available for risk management and cascade testing of family members. And there's actually already reimbursed item numbers and genetic tests for these conditions already in the public health system for people who meet certain criteria. So really, from an adult genetics perspective, they're the tip of the spear or the tip of the iceberg of things that we really know make a difference and move the needle, and we can really help people and help families who are at risk of these conditions, but we're just not finding them current rates of genetic testing.
So why aren't we doing these screenings as a matter of course for these particular conditions?
So the approach to date has been a highly criteria-driven and restrictive approach to genetic testing, and that's partially due to cost. But at the moment, in order to qualify for genetic testing for these three conditions, you have to have had very strong family history and a previous diagnosis often of one of these associated diseases to qualify for the item number. And so just not many people are meeting those criteria, and there's also very low awareness about these conditions, and there's also in some cases difficulty getting access to testing, waiting lists, budget issues, etc. So there's really a huge underdiagnosis problem and lack of awareness. We know what the genetic prevalence of these conditions are, like how frequently pathogenic variants in these genes occur in the general population, because there's been general population studies. And we know that the number of people out there who are at high risk based on their genotype, it doesn't match the number of people who we're finding with the current rates of testing. In fact, we're just scratching the surface. So that really provides a rationale for a population-based testing strategy, which is what we're proposing. The other point is that in certain population-based genetic studies that have taken place where there's been a biobank, an existing biobank that has had genetic testing or genetic screening, when you find people in that population who carry one of these pathogenic variants for one of the genes associated with the conditions I mentioned, and then assess retrospectively whether they would have met the current testing criteria, the majority of them, well over half of them, don't actually meet the current criteria, but they still carry that genetic risk factor and they're still at very high risk of the associated disease. Criteria is too restrictive currently.
Yeah. So would you like to see those opened up and reviewed?
Yes, but what we're actually proposing is to pretty much do away with them altogether and use a population-based testing approach where anyone can get access. But in order to do that, we're now talking about screening, not diagnostic testing. So that's a very important distinction. And the cost per test in order to do that population-based approach needs to come down considerably. And so our research is really about how we can drive those costs down with scale and think about genetic testing as a public health screening exercise as opposed to a diagnostic testing exercise. The result that would be detected from the screening test would still require clinical validation, like any screening test does, in a second validation step. So that's quite a new concept in adult genetic testing, that you would rethink it into the context of a public health screening activity as opposed to a diagnostic test.
So DNA screening isn't available in the public health system at this point?
No.
What does the overseas evidence say about DNA screening?
So there's a lot of evidence emerging, but one of the limitations has been that most of it has come from retrospective screening of an existing biobank population. And there's various issues with that, one of which is you're not always, that population has been collected for general research purposes often, and they haven't been told when to expect genetic results, what type of genetic results to expect. And so often they are returned as a secondary finding or even an incidental finding of other research. And so it can come as a surprise to that participant.
Yeah.
And that really has limited the field. And so what I've called for is to do away with that and have a prospective study where you're telling people upfront, this is why we're doing this, is to find these actionable genetic risk factors. That's the whole primary reason for signing up. It's not a secondary result. It's not an incidental finding. It's a primary finding to be used for prevention and early detection. That's the primary goal. And so our study is really the first of its kind to move into that prospective purpose-built design.
So tell us about the DNA screen pilot study that you've designed.
It comes with input from a wide range of researchers, clinicians, consumer groups across Australia who have been thinking about this for a long time, you know, the issues around equity of access to genetic testing, the high cost of genetic testing, and this underdiagnosis problem, in that people working in the field have thought about this population-based approach for a long time, but this is really a synthesis of all of that background evidence that we've talked about and a proposal for a new study design in a population-based prospective manner that would be endorsed and understood by all the key stakeholders, including all of the familial cancer centres and genetic services around Australia, who we've all got on board, who would be accepting referrals of index cases who we would find through population screening, and that they would know about that ahead of time, and that we would build it in a highly complementary way to those existing services and the existing health system. We're not trying to break the system. We're not trying to replace existing services. We're trying to find high-risk people and feed them into the existing system, just using a new kind of screening approach.
Right.
So we tried to make it highly collaborative, highly evidence-driven, and focused on the real world and focused on, you know, making sure it's built in a cost-effective way in a scalable way, and also a way that appeals to the general public. Because, you know, the big thing that we're trying to do is go directly to the public with this offer of screening and have them sign up online, about the study online, via social media, especially focusing on young adults aged 18 to 40, and having them participate in this study on their off their own bat. So they don't need a referral. They don't need to go to a GP or a doctor to participate. Also, a very important part of the project is gauging that public acceptability and public interest and public understanding of what we're trying to offer to encourage participation and break down some of those barriers in terms of equity of access and awareness that have existed in the past.
Has recruiting started already?
No, so it's set to start on the 1st of July. And to give you a bit of an overview of the way it will work is that we're developing recruitment materials, advertising materials about the study currently, and that they will appear online in July in social media as well as mainstream media. Young people will have the ability to see information about the study in their social media feed, click through the advertisement into a study registration process where they enter their basic details, and we provide information about the study and a video that we're developing. And then we will have a list of registered participants from that process from all across Australia. And the advantage of using online methods and social media is that we can reach groups that were very hard to reach traditionally. So people in rural areas, people in lower socioeconomic, lower educated groups of Australia that traditionally have been hard to recruit into studies, we can use social media as a new tool to reach them. And then we will invite at least 10,000 participants from that registrant list into a second step of the study. And we hope that that group will be representative of the general population by state population size, rural, urban, male, female. And we also have a goal of 25% participants being culturally and linguistically diverse, and 3% identifying as Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander. Cool. That group will be invited to undertake an informed consent step, which is a second step process where we're putting a huge amount of time and thought into how to achieve informed consent at scale for genetic testing using online methods. We'll have video-enhanced information. After they complete that second step, they will be posted a saliva DNA collection kit to their home, which they will provide the sample into a tube, then it is returned, postage paid, will be sent back in through Australia Post to our lab at Monash, where yep. the genetic screening test will be undertaken. And then for the participants who don't have a high-risk result detected, they will receive an electronic notification by email and text message. And for those who we find a high-risk variant in, they'll be contacted by a team of genetic counsellors who have the whole model built based on prior studies about how to responsibly and ethically return medically actionable genetic results to Australian participants, arrange information and a referral for those people into a public genetics health service in their state to then provide an additional assessment, clinical revalidation testing, and subsequent risk management and cascade testing of family members, which we have partnerships built with all of those services in each state. So we've really tried to build that end-to-end process in a highly responsible and evidence-based way. And every component of that process is an important part of the screening test.
I'm chatting with Associate Professor Paul Lacaze, Head of Public Health Genomics at Monash University. His co-authored perspective on DNA screening can be found at mja.com.au, where it is open access. The full link to the article can be found in the show notes for this podcast. Catch up with our back catalogue of episodes at mja.com.au/podcasts. Never miss an upcoming episode by subscribing to our feed through Spotify, iHeartRadio, Player FM, Apple Music, and Amazon Music. Back to our chat. Are you confident that method of recruiting will help people overcome some fears about getting tested?
People who don't want to participate,
Don't have to.
But what we've seen overwhelmingly is that everyone is very enthusiastic and excited about participating. And, you know, they're saying, where do I sign up? And we have to say, it's not quite ready yet. So especially young people are just hugely interested in genetics, very keen to participate. The potential anxiety or that sometimes people talk about, we're just really not seeing it in the public sentiment. You know, it's not to say that there aren't important ethical issues here that we need to think about, and a segment of the population who will be concerned and won't want to participate, but I think they're very much in the minority. I think majority of people are very enthusiastic, especially when they understand that it's about important medical risk factors that they could do something about if they knew about it. It's very different from internet-based genetic testing about family history and ancestry. Like this is important medical information. We're trying to deliver value and benefit to people and their families. And so I think, you know, people appreciate that and they want to participate. So, you know, so far it's been resoundingly positive public sentiment.
What precautions are you taking in terms of privacy, storing of the files after the study's done and all that stuff?
So we know one thought or concern that some people have is with the data security and privacy aspects of genetic testing, where they're DNA information will be stored, how it will be stored, as well as where their DNA samples is stored. And mm-hmm. we take that very seriously and have tried to build a very stringent process for that, where all the DNA samples and all the data will be held securely at Monash University in accordance with very strict data governance policies and privacy policies. Cool. We've also given the participants the option to elect to have their sample and data destroyed entirely after they participate in the screening. And so we know that some people might tick that box. We've made it an optional extra. There's some skepticism, I suppose, in the community because some of these internet-based genetic testing companies have on-selled people's data to third parties. And sometimes things happen with people's samples that they don't know about. Yep. And we want to mitigate against all of those issues. So we've tried to do that and do it with the most transparent way for our study.
Great. So what are the downsides? Are there possible harms of DNA screening?
Yeah, of course. You know, like any type of population screening, there are potential harms, and the harms have to be weighed with the benefits. And that's part of our research, is to understand all of that. And some of the commonly discussed potential harms are the right not to know. Some people don't want to know about future risk or genetic risk in general. And obviously those people don't have to participate. And as I said before, in the context of returning a secondary finding or an incidental result, you don't have explicit agreement of that person that they do actually want to know. Right. So the right not to know is a concern there. But here, we're clearly stating up front exactly what we're looking for and exactly why we're doing it. So people who say yes, they basically are saying that they want to know by participating in the screening. For some people who we detect with a high-risk variant, it then implies their direct blood relatives who have a 50-50% chance of having inherited the same dominant genetic risk variant. And so those people haven't necessarily said that they want to know. They do still have the right not to know, and it's up to them to decide whether they want to have family cascade testing or not. Mm-hmm. And that's mm-hmm. a process that's already dealt with in clinical services every day about how to contact and offer testing to family members. So I think we've kind of addressed that. The other potential harms are over-screening or over-testing. Again, I don't think that's an issue here because there's such a huge problem with underdiagnosis of these conditions in the first place. By finding more people in more index cases, we're actually addressing that problem as opposed to over-testing or over-screening. However, there is an important unknown, which is the future risk of genetic risk of an individual with one of these variants who's detected clinically now with strong family history and maybe even a prior cancer, for example, versus someone from the general population who you find with the same DNA variant in a population-based ascertainment who doesn't necessarily have a family history or any prior evidence of that disease. And do those two people have the same future risk as each other based on that genetic variant alone?
That's a fantastic question, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's kind of a million-dollar question in adult genetics at the moment. So is the penetrance of that same variant the same based on how that individual was ascertained? And we don't know the answer to that yet.
Yeah. And if it's not the same, why isn't it the same?
That's a million-dollar question in genetics as well. Yeah. So it's more than just the one variant. So these monogenic variants that we're looking for will confer a high future risk on their own. But sometimes in one family, they'll manifest far more substantially than in another family. Mm. And so it's probable that that individual with family history is at higher risk than someone who doesn't have a family history. In fact, we know that much is true. But the individual without family history is still at very high risk, and they're still at far higher risk than someone from the general population without that variant. Why it manifests stronger in one family versus another is probably due to other genetic variants that modify risk or modify penetrance. And there's a lot of research being done to try and understand that in more detail. And then there's also the environment and lifestyle also comes into play as well in terms of compounding risk or reducing risk. There's also, you know, the participation in routine screening and surveillance between those two individuals to mitigate their risk. You know, that will have an impact as well on outcomes.
Let me play devil's advocate for a minute. Isn't this just a slippery slope to genetic discrimination and health insurance issues for people who discover that they have these greater risks?
The slippery slope argument is often used in genetics, but what we're trying to focus on is three medically actionable conditions that have met a certain standard of evidence that actionability is encouraged based on the genotype alone. And there's very few conditions that have met that threshold so far. And we are squarely focused on them and them alone, and that we would only ever add genes or conditions to the screening test that met that same level of medical actionability, so that there would be protection against the slippery slope in our strategy to prevent over-testing. And I think it's really important that there is that criteria for inclusion that is rigorously assessed, so that what we're looking for is clear-cut information that you can do something about that is, you know, medically interpretable and accepted by the community as something that we should test for. So I think we can protect against the slippery slope in genetics, and there are other examples from other areas of genetics where that's being done as well, mm-hmm. in newborn screening, for example, reproductive carry screening, etc. The second part about the potential for stigmatization or discrimination against individuals who are identified at high genetic risk is a real problem and something that we need to address separately. And the public understanding part, in that, you know, we all have genetic risk factors for something, and every family has increased genetic risk of something or another. And so it's, although there are people who it's more urgent to identify their genetic risk and offer them risk management, you would hope that they don't become stigmatized in our society because of that. In fact, the whole point would be to do the opposite. It would be it's more an imperative to find them so they can get access to those important services. And, you know, I think most people will understand that. And that's what we're trying to get to in adult genetics, is to find more people in that category. And it'll be huge savings to our health system and our society by helping prevent cancer and heart disease in those individuals. However, there are still problems. For example, life insurance companies are still allowed to use genetic test results in their underwriting decisions. And we, myself and others, have worked for many years to try and address that issue and call for stronger protections and government involvement in how that's regulated. Because currently it's industry self-regulated, which is a problem. But, you know, the potential for getting life insurance has to be weighed with the positive benefit of potentially saving your life by knowing about these genetic risk factors early. You know, that's the message that we're trying to reinforce.
A lot of our listeners are GPs. Will there be a pathway available for GPs to send their patients your way for the study, if they're suitable for
the
study?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, so we definitely want to engage with GPs, make our efforts aware to GPs. The main route of signing up for the study is online. So there's various ways that you can get to that online process, and GP recommendation would be a great one. The current downstream pathway for referral of an index case that we identify in the study for a hereditary cancer is a referral to a familial cancer center, which is the standard pathway for someone with one of these genetic variants, and a notification to the GP about that's happening. And then the subsequent cascade testing of family members for hereditary cancer will be managed by that familial cancer center or genetic service. However, the current model for familial hypercholesterolemia index cases, this is genetic high cholesterol, to have the index case referred to their GP and have the GP manage the validation genetic testing, maybe in partnership with the cardiologist or a lipidologist, and then for the GP to actually manage the cholesterol management and risk reduction and the cascade testing of family members for familial hypercholesterolemia through a GP-based model. And that's just been proposed last year in Australia. And so our study will be, you know, interfacing with that and testing that in an early way and working with GPs, especially for FH, which is at this point in time a separate process to hereditary cancers. We're trying to do this in a highly collaborative way nationwide and really include different consumer groups, clinical partners, clinical services, and researchers to build something that becomes sustainable into the future. And we actually hope that it is a pilot for a potential nationwide DNA-based population screening program one day. And that, you know, we're at the beginning of that journey, not the end. Australia is uniquely placed to actually be able to offer genetic testing in that way in our health system. And we have these great population-based screening programs already available for bowel screening and breast cancer. And we are trying to position DNA screening, adult DNA screening, that would follow those great programs and learn from them and be complementary to them. So we would pick up people younger between 18 and 40 that are very high risk. It doesn't in any way replace bowel cancer screening in people over the age of 50 or mammograms in women over the age of 50. It very much is complementary to those programs. And that we're trying to do it in a way that's guided by the National Population-Based Screening Framework. And we're funded by the federal government Medical Research Future Fund. We want to engage with government, tell them what we're trying to do. We have this whole parallel program of cost effectiveness analysis of, you know, what cost does the genetic screening test have to get down to in order to make it cost effective? You know, what is the likely uptake of the test? What's the likely uptake of the risk management and interventions in index cases that we identify? And modeling, how much does that cost? How much would an annual colonoscopy cost for an individual at high risk of bowel cancer? Modeling all of that out to really see what the impact would be on the Australian public healthcare system. So again, to do it in a highly evidence-based and thoughtful and responsible way is how we're trying to build it from the beginning.
When do you expect to have results?
So we will have the first results by the end of this year in terms of finding new people, new index cases who are at high risk, who won't have been identified by the current system. And that's the primary outcome of our study, is how many people do we find in a population-based way that aren't being found by current rates of genetic testing? And then secondary outcomes being how often are they then participating in surveillance and risk management visits? How many of their family members are receiving cascade testing? And, you know, what are the long-term outcomes in early detection and surveillance that are a result? Thank you.
No, thank you. It's a fascinating subject, and I hope the study goes really well. My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts, or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.